Welcome back to the Amazing Gamers Podcast. I'm your host, Nathan. I am not an amazing gamer, but I am thrilled because I have a whole crew of amazing gamers here today to discuss Final Fantasy VII. And I just want to go around the horn and give everyone a shout out to introduce themselves.
I am Gwent Champ from Detroit, Michigan. Real name, Alex. I have been playing games since I was 5 or 6 years old. A long history with games, and Final Fantasy VII was one of the first RPGs that I really ever played in full, and it really captured my imagination. So I'm excited to talk about it today and dive into its history and all of that jazz. There's a lot to talk about.
Wander, would you like to go next?
Sure. I'm known as Sakura, Kage Sakura. I joined the Final Fantasy fandom way back when it started. It was a thing. I started lurking in like 2005, and I joined one of the forums in 2010. And now I'm here. I've been gaming since I was 3 years old. My father bought me a Nintendo. And it was since then, I've been really into video games. I got into Final Fantasy when I was around 8 years old, but I didn't really get to play one till I owned it at age 16.
Which one was it?
Final Fantasy VII. That was my first one.
Wow. That's a huge win for your dad, by the way. As a dad, I just want to give your dad the proper respect for that's a win. That's a win. Well done. And our final guest is Fax.
Hi, my name is Fax, because I went by FF7 Fun Facts on Twitter, and that was a blast. On Blue Sky, I'm known as Damn the Writer, but often will still go by Fax, just so people who knew me on Twitter recognize me. That, and I haven't really come up with a great shortened nickname for Damn the Writer yet, so I just kind of keep giving myself called Fax. I've been playing video games since Nintendo 64, so many, many years. I got introduced into Final Fantasy VII actually through Kingdom Hearts.
Oh no.
As I was playing, As I was playing that game, I just noticed that there were more Final Fantasy VII characters than any other Final Fantasy game. And so I researched, I was like, why is that? And I did a bunch of research. I was like, oh, okay, so this is a big deal. And started really getting into it before the announcement of Advent Children came out. Watched a full playthrough because YouTube had just came into being like months before Advent Children, which I think plays a factor into the history of the game and how that affected fandom. And then it actually wasn't until after Remake that I fully played the game myself. To be clear though, I did fully play the game before talking about it on any social media. I actually am very recent to social media. Twitter was my first. I've been on social media for about 3 or 4 years now.
You played the remakes before you played through the complete original game? Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, interesting.
That is a unique path.
Okay. Yeah.
So that would be kind of interesting to talk about.
Yes, definitely. So I have a quick aside, and then I'll talk about my Final Fantasy VII story, which is a little odd, but I always tell a story about what matters to me this week, and this week it was about finding what you're looking for. Basically, Friday morning, my daughter, she always keeps everyone on her toes. She's 4. She's going to be 5 in June. She comes in. She basically started a rumor that we were doing Dunkin' Donuts that morning. Like, she acted like she had talked to her mom. And like, oh, yeah, Dunkin' Donuts is happening. And so I talked to her brother, and at that point, I'm locked in. There's no backing out at that point. And then I find out it's news to her mom, but we're going. So I take her for a walk to Dunk's. It's about a mile. And I took her the scenic route. I walk her down one way. We come back the other. Special moment. We get to the end. And she tells me that she had, rode her scooter. She had a little pink bunny that was in the scooter that fell out. And this was a big deal. And I look at my wife, and it's basically like, okay, I'm taking another walk. So I walk the whole circle because, of course, we took a different route back. I had no idea what the bunny looked like. I didn't know if this was a tiny plastic bunny. I didn't know if it was a stuffed bunny. I just had like eyes peeled for a bunny. And about 3/4 of the way, I found it lying next to a spot where we had observed this big wooden gate in front of a driveway. And it made my day to find that little stuffed bunny. And it was just really finding what you're looking for. And I was like, Final Fantasy in a way is kind of about finding what you're looking for. If you think about the different games, it's sort of a through line with a lot of the games in the series. Not all of them. I would say in seven, it definitely is. And I think there's a few themes in seven I like, and I think that's kind of one of them. But in any event, it did save the day that I found her rabbit. I was like, I pray to God this is the pink bunny and not another pink bunny.
Stealing somebody else's stuff.
She was very, you know, you never know, but she was very happy, and it was a massive win. And it's just one of those moments where like one thing matters. And those are just so important, I think, when you're just being drawn so many different directions and trying to keep up with so many different things, and you just have one thing you can focus in on. And when you accomplish it, it's amazing. So here's my Final Fantasy story. I started with Final Fantasy I on the Nintendo Entertainment System, which, amazing game. It raised the bar. I'd played RPGs before that. That was the one where I was like, okay, that's it. This is what it should be like going forward after Final Fantasy I. And then 6 was my favorite on the Super NES. That was my favorite Super Nintendo game, was Final Fantasy VI. And it was just amazing. Loved it. Played countless hours of it in college. Final Fantasy VII comes out. And I'm like, what are you guys doing? They went 3D with it. And I was like, okay, and here's the pain point. I got a pain point coming for y'all. My computer, I didn't have a console then. I took about 10 years of my life where I had no consoles. I went from the Super Nintendo to the PS2. And I was out on consoles for like 10 years because I thought I was all grown up. I needed to stop playing around with video games. I needed to get very serious in my life. So the only way I could play Final Fantasy VII was with my computer. And to play Final Fantasy VII on the computer, you needed like 120 RAM. And mine had about 100 RAM. So when I was doing a limit break, it was like, if you ever wanted those slow motion, dramatic God shots for limit break, I was, so it was hard. I think I got to Junon, and there were parts that I liked, but I just couldn't do it. So I walked away from Final Fantasy for like 10 years, and it was lightning on the cover of Final Fantasy 13, where I saw lightning. And I was like, oh, okay, I need to find out what this is about. And that's when I got back into Final Fantasy. And I went on my PS3 and I downloaded Final Fantasy VII and I finally finished it. I finished it once. And yeah, it was a long, strange journey. And I have like a top 10 of Final Fantasy games. VII is probably in my top 5, but it's on the next tier down from the heavy hitter. So it always amazes me how much people know about this game. And thank you for hearing out my long and boring story. But it was a strange journey with me in Final Fantasy VII.
Did you play on the PS3 at normal speed, or did they have the speed up option? Because you're complaining about how it felt so slow and clunky on the PC. When I tried playing it on regular speed about 2 years ago, the original game, I was like, this is miserable. This is so fucking slow. I cannot do this.
Yeah, I
love this game, but goddamn, it is like, okay, he's lifting his sword and oh, there we go. Okay, 500 down. I was like, how did I do this? I don't know how I did this before. 30 plus times, because I've complained a lot.
30 plus times? Wow, you do love this game.
So my story is that I met this game when I was like, I think 12 years old. It was sixth grade. And it was really the first like full epic RPG that I ever played. And since the age of 12, I pretty much revisited it at least once a year, every year, until my son was born, basically. Just like something I always went back to, because I was always trying to top my previous performance. Like, I don't know. It was like a weird tick that I had. And, I got to the point where I could just take out Sephiroth and like Emerald Weapon with just counterattacks and 4X cuts. And that was it. I just was like, I would just put the controller down and let the game do its thing. And I'm like, I'm a god. Like I did. I think this is about as good as I can get at this. And since then I haven't really gone back as much because, you know, at this point I know everything and it's not as novel as it used to be. There's other games to play.
So is there a chocobo breeding hack? No, don't answer that. I've ever done in my life.
That would be like 15 hours saved, but
You did it more than once.
I always ask my husband to do that for me. I'm like, can you breed the chocobos for me? And he does. He does.
Oh, he's a keeper. He's a keeper.
Right?
Yeah. So the one other thing I'd add about this is the lack of knowledge about Final Fantasy VII is kind of key to how I met Gwen. Because about 2 years ago, I wanted to interact with the fandom, and I got really creative. I basically took a meme, and I took, and I wouldn't say the worst takes, but I definitely took takes that I knew would
spicy,
move the
spicy
needle
takes.
With people.
Yeah, what's up? Yeah. They're like a little spicy, a little spicy.
They were a little spicy. And, you know, I wanted to get, there were ones I always, they're always real. And there are always ones I've heard. I will always have at least one that I agree with. Mm. And the one I agree with in that is that Final Fantasy 13 trilogy is underrated. I think that got way too much hate. It's not my favorite, but if you were there online when 13 came out, it was kind of insane how much people hated on that game. But I wanted to include something about Final Fantasy VII. I kind of had to. I wanted to get at the never-ending debate about the love triangle in there. So yeah. I put in, you know, it's kind of funny. I should have said Cloud doesn't have a canon ship. And that probably would have made things go nuclear. I think like 500,000 people saw that post. Probably it would have been like 20 million if I'd said Cloud didn't have a ship. Because people would have gone just bananas. Everyone would have come at me. But Gwen came into the chat and was kind of like, excuse me, sir. I have a bone to pick with you.
Yeah, I was nice, though. Like,
you were. You
which
were.
Is, you know, good on me, I guess, because typically, depending on what time of day, it could have been attack mode. But you seemed like you were an interesting person and thank not you. Somebody who is... you know, trying to stir the pot in a way that wasn't like just for starting a dialogue. So
I wanted to
the rest, as they say, is history.
Yep, it is. I had to clarify. I was like, okay, I don't actually want to talk about that. if you guys want to talk about it, great. I will say one thing I loved about that. I learned things about the series that I had no clue. A couple of things. The love that I heard for Caius Ballard, I had no idea, but there was probably a half dozen people who told me that Caius Ballard was their favorite antagonist in the series. And I thought about that and I was like, yeah, he's pretty good. He's pretty good. So there was some surprises in there. I didn't get anyone who jumped in to defend Kamari though. I think maybe one or two did that said they liked, you know, he's just a little undercooked. There's always one character in Final Fantasy. Yeah. It feels like it's always undercooked.
Undercooked.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Or a handful.
Or a handful.
I would argue, depending on the game. Except in 6, somehow they have the biggest cast and every character is like fantastic.
Yeah, no. So do we want to go to favorite character or do we have any more about getting into? I think we covered that one. But you are up.
Okay.
Right. Favorite character.
It's a two-part answer because... my understanding, obviously, of this, we'll call it a series because 7 is like this very big compendium of things. And it's evolved as we've learned more information, as the lore has been expanded. So, obviously, right out of the gate, Tifa was one of my favorite characters and has been consistently a really top tier character in my eyes since I first played the game. She's this very compassionate, understanding. Really kind of like the emotional heart, yes, of what makes this story so great. And I think one of the things that's always drawn me to 7 is the internal conflict of the misremembered memories of trauma, of PTSD. And she's really at the heart of unpacking all of those elements and making sense of the world and like who Cloud really is. Obviously, as a kid, I found that very compelling. Like trying to find out who you really are is like something that I think a lot of people can really relate to. And it's kind of angsty and all that jazz, but she's really this emotional core that grounds the story in a very real way. And she feels maybe the most human, the most realistic, I guess, of the main cast, and that she's kind of like this normal girl who got caught up in a bunch of things beyond her control. She made herself stronger so that she could take care of the people that she cares about and take care of herself and fight for them, but got swept up in all of this madness. So part two, now, out of nowhere, this is after Remake and Rebirth, I would argue that Zack Fair is one of my favorite characters. I want to pause right here really quick. You're not this far into the game yet, Nathan, and you did not play Crisis Core. So are you okay with spoilers?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Go for it. Go for it.
Okay. Zack doesn't get as much screen time as I had hoped for in Rebirth. But what we saw in Crisis Core and what we saw in Rebirth is this guy who is facing insurmountable odds, a terrible fate, really. And he faces it with the utmost optimism and humor and humanity. And I just, in this dark world, and I thought like Remake, for example, was just like really oppressively kind of bleak in a way that didn't really resonate with me. But then along comes this guy who is like a ray of light. Even though, you know, we know that he dies and he goes like a hero, all that jazz. He is just this enormously positive presence. And I find nowadays characters like that are really the kind of characters that resonate with me because they still maintain the sense of hope and optimism against all odds. And I think that's kind of a really important thing to see in media right now, even if it would seem cheesy maybe 5-10 years ago. You know, it's just like, I don't know, he strikes a chord with me. So those are my two. I'll kick it over to Sakura.
Hi. So are we still talking about favorite mm-hmm. characters? Okay, so, well, quickly, my story of Final Fantasy VII. I knew about it when I was like younger because my brother always bought those Electronic Gamer magazines, and I liked to draw. I liked to draw the characters, so I would like open up the magazine, pick a random character, and the one that struck me first was Sephiroth. So I saw Sephiroth and I was like, I want this weapon. And I started reading like through the walkthroughs and the reviews, and I couldn't own this game at the time. I was like very young, but I was very interested in what was going on with this character, Sephiroth. He had a black wing and he seemed to be like really integral to the story. It didn't spoil anything saying he was the villain, but it seemed like you fought him a few times. So I was very interested in this Sephiroth character. And so my first favorite character, I would argue, is Sephiroth, actually. People see me, they like, oh, you like Aerith. I'm like, yeah, I like Aerith a lot, but my favorite character was actually Sephiroth for many years. And then when I was 16 years old, I was in Best Buy. And by this time, I had played a lot of different games, but I wanted a game for myself because when I was growing up, it was always me and my brother. Me and my brother always playing games together, and he wasn't really interested in JRPGs, so I never really had the chance to experience those because it was always me and my brother. So I saw Final Fantasy VII, I think it was on sale somewhere, and it was my birthday. I was 16, it was my birthday, and I said, you know what? Today I'm gonna buy something for me. Today I'm buying my game. So I saw the game on clearance and I just brought it home, and I told my friends in high school, hey, I got this game. And they're like, oh, that's so good, you should play it. And I started the game thinking it was about Sephiroth. So here I am playing this game, and there's this blonde guy on my screen, and he's talking to this pink girl, which is Aerith, and I was like, oh, this is interesting. And hours passed, and I don't see any Sephiroth. I was very disappointed in this game.
Yeah.
I get to Nibelheim, and there's a flashback, and you can play as Sephiroth. He's in your party. And then I was like, oh, okay. Now it's going to get
better. Longest cold open ever. Come
on. Yes. And I played. And eventually, you know, you leave the party and it's a flashback. So again, no Sephiroth. So I said, okay, what is this? This is not what I expected. My friends told me this was good. Okay. So I need another favorite character because this isn't working out. So for a while, the character that struck me the most from that point was the pink girl, which was Aerith. So I really liked Aerith. I liked how bubbly she was. I also liked Tifa a lot. So it was basically Tifa and Aerith for a while. I would draw them all the time. My notebooks were full of both. Because I liked the fact that we had women characters taking a lead. That, for me, I had played games before, but it was always like Nintendo games. And, you know, I had never really seen a story-centered game or a character-centered game at that time. So for me, seeing a woman, like, takes a bigger role was amazing. And then we get to the Temple of the Ancients, and they kill off
Aerith. Your two favorites had a scene together.
Whoops. I don't think that we're off. Apparently, <I'm... laughs> and now the character that was like, okay, I can resonate with this, gets killed off in front of me. So I'm like, okay. So I got really interested in, okay, so what is this game trying to tell me? And I started playing, and I got the guide, you know, the guide that tells you everything. I started playing through until I got 100% completion, almost, before I got to Northern Crater. And then my brother said, can I play your game? And I said, sure. And he saved over my file.
No!
Oh! Northern Crater. So I started, you know what? I'm not going to get mad. I'm going to use this as an opportunity to play every single route. So I played every single route until I was satisfied. And it turns out that I ended up loving almost every character. I think the only character that didn't resonate with me by the end of this playing every single route thing was probably Reeve. Kate Sif was the one.
Yes. Yeah. Yep. That's always the one.
I ended up loving
everybody so much that it became my favorite game for like the longest time.
That's great.
Now, if you were to ask me, like, now years later, I would still say Aerith still holds a place in my heart, because that was one of the first ones that resonated with me. But I also really love Tifa. I never didn't like Tifa. She's all over my notebooks. I always found Tifa to be really interesting because, again, seeing a female character so powerful beating up things with her bare hands, for me, that was amazing. I love it.
I know I call her like a normal girl, but like she can like fly and like throw things that are
And in Advent, I was like on board. I was like, this is amazing. When she was fighting laws, I was like, beat him up. And still Aerith, because Aerith for me represents a woman that knows like what she wants, and she like just goes for it. And again, in my culture, that's kind of like, we women, it's a bit of a chauvinistic culture where women don't really get to talk that much, but there are women that kind of go against the grain. And for me, that's what Aerith represented. Being a Latina, to me, I'm very outspoken. I've learned to be that way because of the life I've led. So for me, you know, I'm like, go girl, do what you need to do. And same with Tifa, go girl, do what you need to do. Get revenge if you need to get revenge, do whatever you need to do. So for me, I really like the women characters, and I still like Sephiroth. Like, especially when Remake came out, I was like, oh, finally, now I get Sephiroth. And I'm still really excited to see what they do, because Lifestream Black, I'm seeing a lot of similarities with that. So I would say now I really like Sephiroth. I think it's going
to connect to Lifestream, Case of White and Case of Black a lot. That's I think the plot twist of the re-trilogy is largely connecting Advent Children in a better way to the original than it was.
The bridging that, we're actually going to get the content leading up to it in a meaningful way, which is great, because that movie fucking pisses me off in that all the best stuff happens before the events of the movie.
Yes, it's happening in context. Oh gosh, you're like, who is this Denzel kid again? Watching the original.
You have to read the books that come before. Did you get the pamphlet in the mail?
So my favorite character, we'll kind of go into a little bit into my FF7 story. So a funny thing was, when I played Kingdom Hearts, I did not expect to like Cloud or Aerith. Cloud is, in that game in particular, Cloud is just broody. He breeds more like Squall than he does like
Cloud.
And then Aerith was super duper soft spoken by comparison, very kind of this Madonna like trope. And I was like, I like Kingdom Hearts, but I wouldn't necessarily agree with the characterizations of the Final Fantasy cameos. But I also don't take them that seriously.
Leon? Who's Leon? Why was he called
Leon? Yeah.
Right? Leon? Right? Yes. Okay. But anyway, whole other discussion. So anyway, Advent Children was coming out, and so I wanted to get the context of the first game that this was going to be a sequel to. So I looked it up on YouTube. I didn't have a PS1 at the time. I couldn't afford a $100 game at that time. So I looked it up on YouTube, and I watched the entire playthrough start to finish and fell in love. And what I fell in love with at that time was very similar to what Sakura is saying, is I found it interesting that, one, I didn't even know who Tifa was until I started watching this playthrough. I was like, okay, who is she? Cool. But what I liked immediately was Tifa has this kind of, she's badass, she's wearing a skirt, but she's kind of got the bombshell babe look to her, but she doesn't have the bombshell babe personality. Yeah. Whereas Aerith has this kind of Madonna look to her, but she doesn't have the Madonna personality. And I think Nomura even commented that they purposefully swapped the personalities of the characters to defy those expectations. And so And so that immediately struck me about both of them, was that they subverted a lot of female cliches and tropes in that writing. And then the other thing that struck me with those two was the complexity of their situations and storytelling. And I loved how they were like both like making Cloud do this promise to save them. But in the end, again, it subverts so many gender expectations, because one has failed to be saved. She dies, while the other one ends up saving him. And he sort of fails those male roles, those male expectations and narrative that were so cliche at the time, where the guy saves the girl or whatnot, and then she marries him and bears his children. And that's her whole importance to that story typically. And so I really loved that on all levels. Cloud's my favorite because he's not like a superhero. He's just a guy.
He's kind of a dork. he's a bit of a loser.
And he's got a lot of masculinity issues, which was the fact that it touched on toxic masculinity at all was amazing to me back in the 90s. It was amazing to me mid-2000s. The fact that this was made in 1997 blew my mind as a teenager. I was like, I can't believe they're talking about this in a 90s video game.
Exactly.
Yep.
So, yeah, and I guess I'll go last on this one. So I would have to narrow it down to three, because three of my top 10 favorite Final Fantasy characters are in 7. Tifa is definitely in there. I think we've covered it well. It is I love what they did with Tifa in Remake. I did not enjoy Remake particularly. I'm like a tease for the Final Fantasy haters. Whenever a new one comes out, like, they're all like, I'm like, oh, I don't know. And they're like, oh yeah, he's gonna really dunk on it. And then I'm like, I find a way to enjoy it. And it's like, sorry. Actually, I do like this. It's good. Remake was like the one game where that didn't happen. I appreciated everything that was well done in it, but it felt like less than the sum of its parts. And I am happy for anyone who loved it. It was a major disappointment for me. So I took a long time playing Rebirth because I was afraid that was going to happen again. And it did not. But even in Remake, I loved what they did with Tifa. And I loved how they made Tifa and Aerith friends, like, unmistakably. I loved what they did with Aerith, like, how attractive her confidence was. Like, you could, I got that so much more in Remake than I did in the original game, even though I liked both. So Tifa, definitely. And yeah, just, it's interesting, too, the ungenerous readings of Tifa, where people think that Tifa is being manipulative of Cloud when they first meet in Midgar. And I'm like, I'm like, don't mess with Final Fantasy fans. They've never played the games.
So yeah. Well, you have to willingly read it that way, because the game isn't telling you that's what's going on. It's just like, that's the impression that you want to get. And if you don't reevaluate that, that's on you, because that's absolutely not what's being told.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Sometimes I go back and go, I read some comments like that, you know, and I've heard comments that trash Aerith too, and very similar-ish comments, Aerith manipulated Cloud, blah, blah, blah. And I'm reading these comments and I'm going, You realize Sephiroth and Shinra are the bad guys, right? I mean, it's cool if you don't like Tifa or Aerith. Like, cool, you know, we all have our opinions, but they're not actually the villains of this story. You get that, right?
It's okay.
Wait until it's all going to be revealed in part three. It's really just a domestic drama, and
I'm so excited about.
They really are the spoiler twist. And then just the other two very quickly. It's another did you ever play the game sort of thing. I love Barrett, like absolutely love Barrett, and like he's one of the reasons I bought Rebirth after Remake was such a disappointment, because I was like, we're going to get more of Barrett now. My issue with Remake is it was all set up, and it was like it was the superficial when you first meet them thing. When Rebirth started showing you them becoming a group, and they were kind of going beneath the mask with each other, and like they sort of get past the Cloud tough guy Merc thing and Barrett's bluster and all of those things, I was like, okay, this is working for me now, because I love Barrett. I love how he has a huge heart and a huge sense of justice, and his arc in the original game of how he kind of lost sight of what was most important and comes back to it. I absolutely love Barrett. And then Yuffie, I've had someone on social media. If I was who I was 5 years ago, I might have retweeted this person and sort of held it up. But somebody was like, how can you even like Yuffie in the original game? And I'm like, maybe they didn't do Wutai, but I love that she's brash and fearless, and that it comes from a place of caring, a very deep place of caring about both her people, her community, her family. And there's themes with Yuffie that tie into the big themes in Final Fantasy that I'm hoping to discuss in a little bit. She has a lot of really great qualities. And I also like the rogues, and I like how she's not Locke Cole. She's got a little bit of shadow to her.
Oh, big time. Big time.
You know, she's got an edge to her. And I loved how in Rebirth, they showed Yuffie all business, like right out of the gate, so that you could sort of see that she puts up a front, but she's also all business on several levels. But once you're in her group, like she's 100% invested. But you know, if you're not, look out.
Yeah, she's definitely one of those characters that benefited from these remakes, because she wasn't really on my radar growing up. And many times I never had anything against her. I just felt like her story was very condensed. You had this one segment of the game, and then it's not really threaded through the rest of the narrative. It's just this one piece, right? But that's part of the problem. Like, we'll probably dig into this a little bit, where she was a missable character. Like, she was not somebody that you necessarily would recruit, not canon or whatever you want to call it. So you don't get a ton of her story. There are a lot of great elements to it, and you can see what they're trying to do, but she wasn't really, really fully realized until later on. She's in Crisis Core. You get to see a little bit more of her when she's very young there, and you can kind of see what you're saying, Nathan, like
she one shot
her connection to her connection to Wutai and the pride that she has for her heritage and all of that.
It always interested me how, because I kind of got how Yuffie could be a side character, could be an optional character. I never quite got that with Vincent, other than a programming error, because his story is so threaded into the origin lore by comparison.
Yeah.
Whereas, Yuffie's is worse. I like Yuffie's story. I'm not trying to dissect Yuffie. I like her story. But it is more of like this side quest arc story. So I kind of got where she was optional. But when they talk about Vincent being optional, I'm like, that's missing some major narrative behind the scenes. What happened narrative right there?
That's one of the most infuriating things about the original game, is there's so many things that are missable. Like going to the waterfall to meet with Lucretia on disc 3 with Vincent.
Yes.
Or I just love the dialogue at the end of disc 2 when you have Vincent in your party and you walk up, or he's not in the party, rather. And you're going to fight Hojo, and he's just standing there menacingly, and you talk to him, and he's like, Hojo.
You can skip Gungaga.
Badass. Yes. But yeah, there's just like so much stuff that you can not see. That's insane.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also things that are misunderstood. Gwen is going to bring me up to speed on the things that are, And I'm
I will too. I have notes. I have
you
notes.
You guys need to do this because I'm going to throw this out before we start. I think a lot of stuff in Final Fantasy is sometimes, I would say the list of games where I understand every single plot twist is shorter than the ones where I do.
Well,
so I will say
you didn't play this 30 times though. So, you know, it's okay. Right.
I will say this about Final Fantasy VII. I think Final Fantasy VII has the best Kisho Tenketsu of any Final Fantasy game.
Oh,
Kisho
yeah,
Tenketsu definitely. Is a plot twist narrative, basically. It's got the best plot twist. The other yeah. ones from other Final Fantasies kind of confuse me. Like Final Fantasy X, one of my favorites, I'm like, wait, this is all a dream from a bunch of guys in a pile. They're dreaming up Titus and now he's going to disappear. Okay, I'm confused. Yeah. Or like yeah, Final Fantasy VIII, sure. Okay, there's time compression going on. What is this plot twist? Final Fantasy yeah. IX, another one of my favorites. I'm like, so Zidane is a genome from an outer space guy? Okay. Whereas Final Fantasy VII's plot twist actually made sense and was clever to me. That is one area yeah. where I like Final Fantasy VII better than the others.
15
there's other areas
was just
where I like the other Final
pocket.
Fantasy better than Final Fantasy VII, but that's the one area where I'm like, no, Final Fantasy VII I think is the best, is the Kisho Tenketsu.
15 was so out of pocket in terms, the parts of 15 that worked just really cooked.
Yeah.
And there's just stuff in it where I think part of it is that there was a bunch of DLC that was supposed to happen that never happened. I'm not sure that was the entire reason, but you kind of have to overlook and just sort of savor what works in it and then wonder what might have been.
Yeah.
But that's why I liked 16 is because it was kind of a cohesive story out of the box. And
it was.
And I went and bought the DLC, but I didn't feel like I had to buy the DLC just to understand the base story, which was a huge, I think, benefit. Yeah.
Really quick aside.
I bought the DLC to play more characters and to have more time with the characters, not because I needed it as core narrative understanding.
So you needed it. You needed it in 15 because I thought Ignis was annoying the whole game. And I played episode Ignis and I was like, I love this guy. I was like, why didn't they show us that in the game? Because it explained why he was so dedicated to Noctis and like completely selfless. Mm-hmm. And like, yes, he's a butler and he serves people, but he also draws on who he is. And just for them to take that out was just, I thought that was a big mistake because probably most people never played that. Sorry to jump in with that one, but that was one of my strong takes on 15 was the character development should have stayed in the game. But to misunderstand I misunderstood Ignis.
No worries. Well, and the writing with 15, the writing of the core four characters is so well done. And then the writing of every single side character just about in the rest of the game is really not good. Really not good. Like I didn't really care about a single side character. It was really just the four boys. They had the best dialogue, the best everything. And so I was like, okay.
Yeah. So the misunderstandings with 7, lay it on me. I want to understand because there's a lot of knowledge I need on 7.
All right.
I'm not even sure if Bob winds up with somebody in the game. I need. What's that?
I said, Gwent, do you want first round or do you want to give it to me?
You know what? I'm going to tee both of you guys up here. I'm going to tee you up and then you can dig in because I feel like this is really where, you know, you've lived and breathed a lot of this. But you know, what's so confusing about 7 is it's a game that we've all come at different points in our lives, right? Like I played it when I was 12 when it first came out. And so, you know, my understanding of it back then was maybe a little bit more elementary, but I kept playing it. And my knowledge of what was happening and the narrative grew as my own knowledge grew. And so I became aware of more things. And I think, you know, some people play this game and they didn't go past disc one. That's a frequent battle that we kind of have with folks that are these armchair experts who never even completed the original game, never bothered to really go through everything. Or it's just like what interests you, right? Certain scenes are so impactful. But some people, if you don't like Tifa, you're not paying a ton of attention during the live stream sequence, which is the most important segment of the fucking game. Like, it's when the internal plot completely is revealed. And if you're just not like, you don't like Tifa, you're just like click, 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 and skipping dialogue. Because there's not action, it's just exposition. You're learning about the characters in this intimate moment. And you could just skip you could skip right through that. And it doesn't even have any impact on you. You have no recollection of what's going on here. There's just so many factors that go into one's understanding and appreciation of this game. It's how you're reading it and how you're coming to it, when you're coming to it. But beyond that, there's the entire compilation, right? So you have Crisis Core, which was made in 2005, I think. Is that correct?
2007 was when it was
2007.
Released.
Okay. 2005 was Evan Children, my bad. Which is wild. What the fuck? And we also talked about all the things that were missable, too. Like, in the game itself, Zach, all right? He is this character that's just, like, kind of thrown in there. And his biggest scenes, the most important contextual scenes for him, are entirely missable. When I first played the game, I think the first two times, I just walked right past Gungaga. I didn't go there. I just walked past him. I didn't get any of that background, any of those scenes in the original game. So I'm like, okay. The first time I think you see him then would be in Nibelheim or in the flashback when you're like piecing together memories. And you're like, who the hell is this black-haired guy? Okay. That's who Cloud's supposed to be. Okay, cool. So there's like all this stuff that's missable. And then there are the books that Nojima wrote that have really great content, but not everybody's like picking that up and reading to figure out what's happening in the lead up to Advent Children or the things that happen after it. There's the Kids Are All Right, which takes place after Advent Children. And there's just all this stuff. So there's too much to really to unpack. And now you have the remake games, which thankfully kind of are acknowledging all of those things and trying to put it into a place that is manageable and leveraging those elements.
Cohesive. So
I'll shut up now. So that's the tee up.
All right. Okay. So, okay. Go ahead, Sakura. Here.
So, I'm just going to say a few reasons why I think it's so misunderstood based on the fact that I joined the fandom in 2005. So I've seen how misconceptions have changed over time. One of the things that caught me when I first started playing is it wasn't like any game I had ever played because I was so used to playing Western games. This is the first game, and a lot of people don't realize this is the first Japanese game that blew up so much that everyone knew about FF7. Even when it came out, even like years later, everyone knows something about FF7. They either recognize Cloud, or they know that Aerith dies, or they know who Sephiroth is. This had never happened before. And now you're introducing this game to an American audience, right? Who does not know how Japanese games play or how Japanese games work. So a lot of the things in the original 7, and I have argued this, people will argue now remake is a little more global, but I will argue OG was the most Japanese game I've ever played in my life, and I have played many Japanese games. It was the most Japanese. So if you don't have that cultural knowledge, a lot of things are just, you're not going to know what's happening. And the way that the game plays is like how a Japanese JRPG plays, but it was one of the first RPGs for many, many people at the time. They did not know what to expect. They did not know what affection points meant. They thought that affection points meant this is my girlfriend now, right? They did not understand what bonds were or sisters. After that, Shin Megami Tensei became more popular, we have the social links. Now we understand more where the affection system comes from. Mm-hmm. But that was a thing, even like Chrono Cross and things like that, didn't really introduce too much until more recent times. FF7 was the one I would argue showed it to the most people. Now you're showing it to a lot of people, and they're not all going to understand. They're all playing it at young ages. I played it at 16. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The live stream scene flew over my head the first time. At the time, Evangelion was really popular, and Xenogears was getting off. It was getting more popular too.
Really, Japanese media culture was starting to come into, because like Power Rangers, Sailor Moon, that was all that same kind of decade. Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So a lot of those ideas of Evangelion, which was more philosophical, is what went into 7. 7 was actually based a lot on Evangelion, a lot, especially the live stream scene. And I've done analysis on this. So a lot of those ideas were not part of what we normally would expect when playing a Western game, which is what everybody was used to at the time. So we didn't really know how to take it in, and we were young.
I had no idea. This is things. The thing that I knew was that how did Final Fantasy go from 3 to 7? Like, what happened here? Because it was 3 yeah. in the States on the Super Nintendo, and then suddenly it's 7. I'm like, but it was like the first that was released concurrently everywhere. That was when they started coming out the same time everywhere, which was sort of for me. But I think I'm much more interested in hearing facts on this topic of the misunderstandings and the cultural things.
All right, so I'm not going to touch too. I will touch a little bit on Japanese language versus English because they're very different, and that factors into localization that happened in the original game. Yeah. But I'm not going to touch too much on Japanese culture in this cast. What I am going to say is, according to this part is from fandom. I didn't count the number of developers. I thought about it before this podcast, so take it at general value.
Oh, no.
But according to fandom, Final Fantasy VI developers was only around 50 to 60 because games back then were much more simple. Final Fantasy VII, which was on a new system, presented with new bells and whistles, all that, incorporated 100 to 150 developers.
God.
So what happened was suddenly the game blew up in a development, if we're talking about in a development sort of way. And where they were used to more delegating and communicating and talking to much smaller teams of people and kind of being able to make more decisions by the seat of their pants, suddenly they jumped technology, jumped in size, jumped in scope, and they didn't adjust for it enough. And so the development for Final Fantasy VII, on the one hand, is was big and amazing, did so many things. On the other hand, as you're playing it, kind of bubblegum and duct tape in a lot of areas. It shows that jump in developers and that kind of messy internal communication shows. So here we have some comments from the 10th anniversary of Final Fantasy VII interview. It's between Kitase, Nojima, and Nomura. For context, Kitase was the lead developer, the lead director of the game. Nojima was the lead writer for the game. And Nomura was the lead character designer. So this will give you a sense of it. Kitase, I didn't know until we were in the latter stages of development that Cloud's memories were Zack's. So he didn't even know. The lead director of the game didn't even know about Zack until they were nearly done.
So it's Nojima, not just me.
It's not just you. Nojima, when I joined the development team, the concept of Aerith seeing her first love again in Cloud was already there. So I brought it into that link with solving the mysteries. So basically, originally, they were going to have Sephiroth as Aerith's love, and Cloud was going to remind her of Sephiroth. Then they brought in Zack very late in development. Nomura, about the concept of seeing her first love again in Cloud, at first, we were thinking of making that man Sephiroth. When I got the request for the illustration of Zack, we were already near the end of development. All right, so they were near the end of the development, hadn't really come up with Zack until about the end. So now the interviewer basically asked Nojima, did you know about Zack and Cloud from the very beginning? Nojima, no. I thought of it as I went on with my work. So at the beginning, there wasn't much foreshadowing. The foreshadowing scenes, I asked the staff in charge of the event scenes to add after development reached a point where an outcome for the mysteries came into sight. Kitase, in those days, it was easy to go back and change things around later on. Lately, with the workload involved in making the graphics, it's hard to ask people to change something once it's been finished. Nojima, well, even back then, there were some people who could easily ask to change an event later on, and people who were difficult to ask. So the locations of the foreshadowing might be biased. I imagine he's talking about like Calm and Junin, where you see the most heavy foreshadowing.
Yeah.
Yep. I only went to the people who were easy to ask. And the foreshadowing is focused at the scenes they were in charge of. Laughs. So a lot of stuff got changed mid, kind of flying by the seat of their pants, coordinating with over 100 different people while flying by the seat of their pants, and then didn't communicate with everyone on what changes were being made when, which is why some of the scenes don't always line up in terms of dialogue and whatnot. On top, so that's part of the misconception right there, is so much was changed kind of in this clunky way that, like Gwen was describing, you can miss whole parts of dialogue. Yeah. And that's because it was tacked on later. The original,
right? Sorry.
No, you're good. You're good. So was to answer that first question, it was, he kind of was. But so the scene where Zach saves Cloud, that wasn't in the original. They released the game in Japan and then added some content for the international release, the worldwide release to America. And one of those was the scene where Zach saves Cloud. It's called the international version. So yes, in the original, that scene where Zach saves Cloud was not in it, but there are other scenes featuring Zach. I think they just tacked that on realizing, whoops, we don't have context for who Zach is and what, why he's important.
When you say he saves Cloud, is that the one where he's taking him out of the tank? Dragon?
Yes. Okay. Yes. That was added after
the banjo. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Just making sure. Yeah.
All right. So that's the first
It's amazing. Part. They were able to tell a cohesive story given everything that you've just said. Like, did they tell this very compelling story when everybody was just like putting things together in different places? It's
yes, it kind of is amazing.
It's crazy.
Okay, then there's part two, localization. So, localization conversation is very different from back then than it was today. So, I'm going to table any remake debate controversy because OG was very different circumstances. Mm-hmm. Back then, localization translation was off-site, meaning they did it in the US, not in Japan. Now it's done in-house. They do it on-site at Square Enix headquarters. That wasn't the case then. It was sent over by text file. So think about when you're translating, looking at an Excel spreadsheet. You're seeing the Japanese text and you're expected to then translate to English like a spreadsheet. Sometimes the spreadsheet was sent to you out of order. So you would get scenes out of order trying to translate. It was one person often translating. So again, going back to how big FF6 was versus how massive FF7 was. They sent it to, again, same process, one guy to translate the whole game, which was like
way bigger
than what they'd done before.
Not enough coffee in the world.
Yep. Yeah. For the challenge he was given, I'm like, Michael Basket did a great job. It's still a mess because they gave him a mountain. And then last, just to make things even goofier, the French, Spanish, and German, basically the other foreign languages, were not translated from the original Japanese. They were translated from the English.
From English, yeah.
Yep.
There you go.
So they're even worse. So obviously, there's a lot of translation mess with this situation. And one of the hardships about translation from Japanese to English is Japanese is what is called a high context language. A high context language basically means they cut out a lot of information from what they say. And it is on you, the listener, to pay attention to context of situation, body language, and vocal tonation to understand their meaning. So for example, let's say you have two characters going to a donut shop and one guy says, "You want a donut?" And the other guy says the word ski. Ski can mean like or love. Now let's say this character's named Dave. He says, "Yeah, sure, I ski donuts." In English, you would probably translate that to like based on his tone. Now let's say scene two, he says, "Oh yeah, I ski donuts." Based on his tone, you would be inclined to translate it to love. Mm-hmm. Because it's just tone. But in the most technical sense of the word, at all times for ski, like and love are both correct. It would just sound weird. And that's what's considered a mistranslation by Japanese to English standards. It's basically a smart guess. It's a good guess. So now imagine trying to do something like that where a bunch of information is dropped without being able to actually play the game yourself. You're just looking at a text file with a bunch of missing information. Mm-hmm. Another common thing they do is they drop pronouns all the time, whereas in English, they have to be put back in. So a really famous one, a debate, is the ending scene at the ending of Final Fantasy where he says, I can meet her there. What it actually was in Japanese was think meet there. Because in Japanese, it's super common to drop pronouns. And so now there's a never-ending debate as to whether or not Michael Basket misconstrued what the pronouns were supposed to be or whether or not they're correct.
I feel bad for
Japanese to English translators. I really do, because that's a train wreck.
Can I say one thing about translations? Because I only speak English, but I have read two translations of a book. And I think people who've never done that kind of underestimate the subjectiveness of translating. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite books of all times is Romance of the Three Kingdoms. It's one of the four classics of Chinese literature.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And I've read two translations of it, and there are absolutely subjective elements. There's choices in localization. One has figures of speech that it repeats verbatim. They're just non sequiturs. The other one is more localized, where it tries to make that figure of speech into something that the reader is more likely to understand. And I think people who've never had that experience sort of underestimate there is a subjective element. There's decisions that are being made when you are translating and localizing. It's not as simple as some people might imagine it to be. That's my own two cents. I'm not familiar with this one, but whenever I see that translation debate come up, I'm just like, unless you've read two translations of something, it helps give some perspective.
Yeah. Well, like I was on a small team where fans, where we translated Cloud's short novel.
1,000 Guild to Be a Hero, is that right?
Yes, thank you, yes. Yeah. I was, one person was in charge of direct translation from Japanese to English, so they translated directly, and I was in charge of flow and localization. And that's the other part, I think, is a lot of people will, like, if any changes are made, people get upset, and what they don't understand is how much, like, gobbledygook a direct translation from Japanese to English would actually be.
It makes no sense if you do it that way.
It makes no sense if you do an exact translation, and not at all.
Yeah.
And so I had to add a lot of information, even just like there'd be whole sections of dialogue. And again, Japanese doesn't really commonly use pronouns, so they would just be talking and you're supposed to figure out who's speaking. And so to make it read like English would normally, I had to insert, he asked, she replied, he said, even just phrases like that, I had to insert. Otherwise, it reads terrible. But anyway, going back to Final Fantasy VII, so what happened was a lot of stuff got messy translations. Some things got cut entirely by mistake. So there's whole lines of dialogue in Japanese that's just straight up missing in the English and by extension, the other languages, since they were translated from the English. And so, it really doesn't surprise me that there's a lot of misconceptions about this game. I think what kind of surprises me now a little bit about it is we do in general kind of know all this stuff. It's not a mystery. It's not like a kept secret. The information's out there. I think a lot of people just don't kind of ignore it.
It's an unwillingness to engage with the material. Like, you can find the sources. You can evaluate these pieces of media critically. You're just choosing not to, or choosing to hold on to a perception of a game that you played when you were 14 years old and not letting that go. But like the game has evolved, the lore has evolved, and the information that we receive consuming this media has completely changed and updated, and it's all gone.
You know, it is just a video game. I don't expect everyone to be as obsessively expertise as the people in this panel are and myself. But the thing is that when you don't do that and then go online or go into any public space and then act like you're an expert and then you're going to get proven wrong very quickly against actual experts and getting upset after the fact is a little like, okay,
Yeah, and it's frustrating to argue with somebody where you're like, here is a screenshot of the thing you said did not happen. It did happen. So, like,
I feel
what are we doing
seen.
here?
I feel seen, Blair. I feel
What are
seen.
we doing here?
What are we doing here? Yeah.
So I'm gonna identify and sympathize because when I played Type Zero, and I've said this and I had people come in hot, and I'm like, nope. I do choose to believe that the happy ending of Type Zero is what really happened. I know it's not, but I don't know if you guys played Type Zero, but there's a happy ending where like they all get to go on with their lives. It's like what it would have been if there hadn't been that.
Right.
And I was like, I do choose to believe. And everyone's like, no, it's not the canon ending. I was like, I know, but I'm just choosing to believe this because I like to, it's just kind of unfair the break that that crew got, and they were such a good group. I liked Type Zero probably more than I should have. It was the most Persona of Final Fantasy games for me, and
Ooh,
yeah,
I'm gonna have to check it out then. I'm gonna check it out.
it's got some Persona
Nice.
Light. It's got a time system. You have to play it twice to
Okay.
finish everything. There's people you have to interact with to make things happen over the course of the game. So it's a little bit. I don't want to build it up too much, but yeah, you could definitely sort of feel you have to think about how you spend your time. And speaking of time, I do want to ensure we get to one more piece that I wanted to mention. My big theme with Final Fantasy VII, and please, you can tear me apart if I'm totally wrong. I love Final Fantasy doesn't always have themes. I feel like it really doesn't. Sometimes it does, and it's like, oh, that's wonderful. Sometimes it doesn't. Final Fantasy IX, The Chef's Kiss, my favorite in the series, just loaded with
Yeah,
themes. And
agreed. Agreed.
it
Mine
piles up and it's beautiful and I love it. It's my favorite. Seven has some though. It does. And I think one of them, and we were talking about Yuffie earlier, I really think a big theme in that game is that the past is the past, and the best that you can do is figure out what you're gonna do next. And I think that's Yuffie's story. I think that's Red 13's story. I think that's Barrett's story. I think it factors in with Tifa. It factors in with Cloud. I don't know about Kate Sith, but I think for a lot of the characters, even for Cid, the way that he had the disappointment with this rocket and he had to stop moping around his rocket and figure out what he was going to do next. I do feel like that's a major theme for it. It's one of the things that I like about it. It's one of the things that resonates about it with me. The overall story, I can't quite follow at times. But the way that it's a group of people who had some misfortune in their life and they sort of get some perspective on things. Like, I always love the story about Red 13, even though he's not a huge character in the original. The whole thing of how he comes to understand the same way that Yuffie did. Like, I love that. So, for me, that was something that really worked for me in the OG. And I'm hoping to see some more of that in Rebirth.
You're not wrong in reading that. But Seven has a lot of themes. There's so many different things to unpack in this game, and so many angles. We talked a little bit earlier about the external plot, saving the planet, right? Versus the internal plot, which is kind of like Cloud discovering who he really is. But all of these characters are kind of on that journey, trying to, figure out who they are, and also trying to make peace with their pasts. I think I was talking to you on the side about memories, because
Power of
they
memory.
weigh heavily on the interactions all these characters have with each other. Everybody's got their own unique, backstory. And that's the one that stuck with me the most, because it felt so personal, trying to overcome your own trauma. You look at Tifa's story. The real shame about these games is that you don't really get to see a lot of this stuff. Like, you get the hint in the Vanilla Hill flashback where her mother passes away and she goes up to the mountain and falls. And this is like a source of an enormous trauma for both Cloud and Tifa. But then, of course, the burning of their town weighs heavily upon them, and they have all of this stuff that they just need to unpack. And they're trying to move forward, carrying this enormous burden. And one of the rewarding things that I hope we see in the next installment is them really digging into that and unpacking some of that trauma and working through it. Because up to this point, we're not really, seeing that so much in the remakes. You're getting a taste for what weighs on these characters, but not them really working through it yet, because there's still a lot left to be revealed. but I'm gonna stop there and let the others speak a little bit more about thematics.
I'll weigh on themes. I kind of always thought about when I think about the themes of Final Fantasy VII, I almost feel like Tifa and Aerith personify what could arguably be the two biggest themes in Final Fantasy VII. Aerith sort of personifying loss and the beauty of brevity, that nothing is permanent, nothing lasts forever, and kind of just that theme of loss. Whereas Tifa is sort of the theme of self-identity, and touches on that. And so it's interesting the way the story kind of branches in those two major paths quite a bit.
And the flowers, her flowers are associated with Aerith, and I'm walking around seeing the cherry blossoms fall. And anyone who's ever played Persona 3 probably can't look at cherry blossoms the same way ever again after that.
Well, okay, I'll make a point about that one. So the beauty of brevity, that nothing lasts forever, the phrase in Japanese is mono no aware, and it's a big deal. And the flower that symbolizes mono no aware is the sakura blossom, the pink cherry blossom, which very much ties with Aerith.
That's amazing. I had no idea. Oh my gosh. Do we want to wrap up with Rebirth? Our thoughts on Rebirth?
Sure.
Yeah.
Who wants to go first?
I'll go last.
All right. I know some of your thoughts on Rebirth. I will just say before we go, I've talked to everyone on this pod about it. The word burnout has come up very frequently, but let's see what everyone thinks. I don't want to bias anyone's thoughts because I have my own thoughts.
You haven't finished the game yet, man. You haven't.
I haven't, so I haven't got you to
me when you're done.
Let me defend myself. I'm going to defend this hill. I went into this being like, I heard there's a ton of mini games. If any of it feels like bullshit, I'm just walking away. I am not going to suck it up and try and finish everything. I'm not going to be a completionist because I get caught up in being a completionist. I was like, nope, I'm going to have fun. If it's not fun, I'm done. And I've had fun so far. It's been a lot more fun than I thought it was going to be. Like sticking it to Fort Condor. Oh, yeah. Like when I stick it to Fort Condor, it's and Queen's Blood, a lot of fun. So some of the stuff I'm not interested in, and like the Moogles, I'm like, oh, God, I am not finishing the Moogles because I completely.
The Moogles.
Yeah.
It's like, no, you're supposed to be cute scamps. I hate you, Moogle. Sorry. But so I'm not going to try to finish it, but I'm just going to enjoy what's in there to be fun. And just let me throw this one out there. Being exposed to the music of Nobuo Uematsu again, on our way. I mean, there's just moments in it where Nobuo Uematsu moves me so deeply. And Final Fantasy has good music to this day. Uematsu was very special, and there's just moments in when I'm playing Rebirth where I can feel that, and I just kind of soak it in, and I just love it. So yeah, it's been wonderful like that. So that's kind of me saying I'm liking it so far, but I haven't finished it, so we'll see what I think when it's over. I was not expecting to be a big fan of this game and enjoy it as much as I have, so that's been a surprise W. That's my two cents on it. Sakura?
Yeah, so I'm a purist. So you get the purist opinions. First, I want to mention beforehand what these devs are doing is very interesting, because I feel like another reason that 7 is so misunderstood, it's one of the games that the story OG alone was fine and you could have left it there, but they went further into the compilation. And what that does is it made it dependent on something called media mix. Japanese games are a victim of media mix. Media mix is when you tell a story in a game or a movie or whatever, but then you add to it novels, comics, other things that give you context for things you need to understand the game. So Final Fantasy VII OG was fine as is. I will die on this hill. It was perfect the way it was. And I don't think that what fans were asking for was to go into a new story, but that's what the devs did. They started Crisis Core, which was used to give background, and I really liked Crisis Core you know, I have my gripes with it, but I liked Crisis Core. Yeah. And then they went into Advent Children, and I'm actually a fan of Advent Children. I love Advent Children. I feel it was talking about the theme of loss. I resonated a lot because I lost a friend at the same time, and I've dealt with that. So for me, I felt like a Japanese story talking about mental illness in a way that's not, you know, making it a taboo was amazing. And I thought that was great. So I do like that they're incorporating these other stories, even though I think OG was perfect as it is. I think the stories that they incorporated after, they're trying to link them all up now to make up for the fact that they went into a compilation and did this whole media mix thing. There were Ultimanias. Mm-hmm. Ultimanias did not, were not a thing until like 2007, 2009, by the way. Mm-hmm. So they weren't even translated until like 2010. So there's a lot of context loss. You have all these stories separately. So I think it's good that they're reuniting them now. However, so I really liked Remake up to the ending. I will say something about Rebirth. I like Rebirth up to the ending.
Yep.
I think the way that they kind of put themselves in a corner and it's not their fault, they made it so that they're remaking a game that people already know the plot twists. All of them. We know all of them. We're fans. We know all of them. So
well, they're trying to make it
so that there's newness. So that the purists don't get bored. And they're trying to make it so that new players have a refreshing take because we already know all the plot twists. What do you do when everybody knows all the plot twists? You add new plot twists. So that's what they're going for. But the way that they're doing it, I feel like it didn't need to be the way they did it. And I feel so many of us, and I think even new players, would have been so happy with just what we had in OG.
I agree. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Without the plot twist. And I think this is just how modern games are now. You know, they're trying to compete with the market. So that's just how it is now. Mm-hmm. But I enjoyed it, both until Remake and OG, Rebirth until the ending. That's what I'll say.
I have to just belabor that point because I feel like the last chapters of both games are the worst chapters in both games.
Yeah.
You're just like, what are you doing? Like, but I'm not gonna, I'll dig into a little bit more facts. You can fire
away. Oh yeah, no worries. I'm pretty much kind of with Sakura on this. You know, it was kind of a thing that Square Enix was doing when it became Square Enix, partially because it needed to fund its merger. They started as Squaresoft, they merged with Enix, became Square Enix, and so to fund that merger, they milked two of their greatest IPs at the time, which was Kingdom Hearts and Final Fantasy VII. And that's how the comp largely got born, was to basically fund that merger. And also, they became much more corporate at that time. It's a bit of a mess, like having to, we've talked about, read this book and then go watch this movie and then do this and that, just to understand a general story. Ugh. And as someone who owns a bunch of the Ultimanias, actually own the guidebooks, I don't feel like we should have to in order to understand the story. But that's kind of where we're at, because it is just such a mess in that way. As for my opinions on the Re-Trilogy, I actually got, so with Remake, because I always research games, I'm just weird that way. I actually got split on the ending. And reading it on like Wikipedia or whatnot, I was like, oh, they're going to change things. It read like Star Trek. And I was kind of like, oh, that sounds interesting. Maybe. But the way it was executed in Remake, I didn't like the execution. I thought it was a mess and kind of just left field, not well paced. So I liked Remake up until the ending. I ended up liking the ending less than I even expected to. And I knew it was going to happen. With Rebirth, I still didn't care for the ending, but liked it more than I thought I would. Because the moment I heard that they were going to end that game at the death of Aerith, I was like, that sounds kind of messy. That's a weird spot to just stop your story. I was kind of on the point with others where we thought the game would end better with Meteor falling from the sky and then cliffhanger like that, like an Empire Strikes Back kind of moment where all shit has now hit the fan. Oh no, how are they going to resolve this for part three? Whereas ending it on the death of Aerith was just kind of like a weird, just a weird stopping point. But so I went into Rebirth expecting to really not like the ending at all. And maybe it's because my expectations were a little low and Nathan, I think, just kind of had the same moment. Yeah. I actually wound up liking it and the whole game more than I thought I would. So I didn't love the ending, but I liked it more than I thought I would. And as far as the rest of the game goes, like, it kind of same, my expectations were kind of more middling because it was covering the parts of the game that largely are my favorite. My favorite scene is the life stream sequence. My second favorite scene is the calm flashback. So that was the one scene I was like so excited for. And then my third favorite scene is when Zach rescues Cloud from the Shinra Manor, the secret scene. It's actually my third favorite scene in the game. I'm looking forward to that. So, yeah, I mean, really the biggest scene, obviously, I was still looking forward to Inanaki's backstory. I was looking for Barrett's, but they're not among my favorite parts. They're just in the story. Yeah. My favorite really was the calm flashback. So for not covering my favorite part of OG, I actually wound up liking it a lot more than I thought I would overall.
I finished Tokyo Mirage Sessions before I played Rebirth. I sat down and finally dug into Tokyo Mirage Sessions, which is kind of a hidden gem, before doing Rebirth. So I put it off as long as I reasonably could, and I was pleasantly surprised. I think expectations are key. I think Final Fantasy, I've written about this twice, where I think people just beat the series up because they go in with these expectations that are just, like, does it need to be life-changing? And you sort of see it with Star Wars. Final Fantasy is a lot like Star Wars in a lot of ways. And it's like,
yes.
Does it need to be life-changing? Or can you just enjoy it for some time and have it take you away from whatever's going on in your life and just have some fun with it?
Oh, I think that's why maybe you're enjoying it better than I did, right? Because you don't have this endless back catalog of knowledge about this game that I do. And so, like, that's really where a lot of my frustration stems from, is that I love these characters. And I do think both Remake and Rebirth really expand on these characters in meaningful ways that we didn't really get in the original game. I keep coming back to Tifa, but she's really the shining example of a character who benefited from this expanded lore and getting more screen time, seeing her body language and reactions to things. The storytelling is quite good there with the characters, and you haven't gotten to Gungaga yet, but Gungaga is my favorite chapter in
the surprise amazing chapter in Rebirth.
It's so good. It's so,
who knew?
The environment which is Gungaga? Sucks. Is that Barrett it's, with his friend?
No.
That's chapter
Gungaga
9.
Is like, I'm not going to spoil anything. Chapter 9.
In the OG, it's where you find out about Zach. In Rebirth, a bunch more happens, and it's my favorite in terms of story part.
That's optional in OG.
Yeah, right, yes. Exactly. So this is not optional.
Union
you get
was my
a lot of story. And I think they did a really great job doing that. The other characters too, you get a little bit more from Barrett. You get a bit more Inanaki. What I take issue with is the execution, because a lot of times this game is telling a very good story and I just want them to shut up and tell me the story. I want these characters to be quiet and have a conversation with each other. That's the most infuriating thing, right? Is like, these people are not getting enough time together to have meaningful conversations before some bullshit happens. Barrett's scene in Coral is so fucking bad. I'm so sorry. It's just like, oh,
because
pretty bad.
You are like, you're having this emotional moment. He's confronting Dine. They have a battle. But instead of letting that settle and just like let the moment sit, let them sit in the feeling, let him sit in his sorrow, you get fucking Palmer come out of nowhere. He's like, oh, I got this big stupid machine. You've got to fight another boss fight. And then you're like in a Gatling gun in the back blasting things. I'm like, oh my God, what have you done?
Like, that's gonna hurt for me.
Yeah, it's just, it's not good. Like there are a number of like key quiet moments that are really poignant in the original game where you just kind of have to fill in the blanks yourself as the player, as the gamer. And that was something that weighed really heavily on me playing the original game. This game often goes for bigger, more all the time. Bigger explosions, more lights, more show. Another moment where I was just like, I'm not having fun anymore was that I think it's the second trip to Gold Saucer. You guys know what I'm talking about, the boss.
Yeah, it's got another twice.
The boss gauntlet, where it's like, okay, you're fighting Don Corneo and then his goons. And then, oh, wait, guess what? You also have to fight Rufus. And it's like, can we fucking stop? I just want to, like, hear what these characters are thinking and experiencing and sit in that experience with them instead of just like, I'm throwing my sword all over the place. Like, I'm tired. I'm physically tired from this.
It felt kind of like it was trying to be Final Fantasy 16 in that little moment right there.
I know. But like in the worst way possible.
It just, yeah, yeah.
Those were too much. Those battles in 16, like, were too much. It was just like, yeah. I was like, please stop. I was like, stop. Yeah. No.
I'm tired.
I can't anymore. They would go on and on, like the Aeon battles. And I talked to people who love that. That was their favorite part. And I was like, it was good, man. But at some point, too much is too much.
This is why I like Persona. You know, it's like I get to have those one-on-ones of these characters and slowly unpack what's meaningful to them, what they're dealing with. This game doesn't let you do that in a lot of ways, and it's really frustrating. And the other major criticism I have is I feel like the regression when it comes to Tifa and Aerith's relationship. You see that really starting to blossom in Rebirth, or sorry, in Remake. But then Rebirth, they're like, it's gone. What you had been building up is no longer really part of what's happening in the game. And I was hoping to see a lot of cool scenes with them, maybe see them have a one-on-one conversation and exchange any sort of, I don't know, intimacy information with each other.
Yeah.
You don't get that. You get like some giggles and a few high fives, and it's like, what the fuck? Like, I wanted to see so much more from these two characters than what you gave us. And I think that was largely...
interactions were actually with Nanaki in Rebirth.
Yes. Yeah, they have the best character-to-character chemistry, I felt like. Mm-hmm. Just like, I think Tifa and Yuffie had some pretty good moments. But, like, I just... I wanted to see more of these characters interacting with each other. I wanted to see more of them actually getting real with each other and digging in. I was so frustrated at the calm in scene when Tifa and Aerith are in their room and then you think they're going to have this conversation. It just cuts away. You're just like,
yeah.
Oh my God. Like, I understand you can't reveal a lot of what's being said, but show me something. Show me. That's one of the biggest criticisms I have of this entire, you know, the compilation is that so much is shown or it happens off screen. You don't get to see these critical moments of these characters engaging with each other. You just have to either read about it or assume something happened. I wanted that. And I just didn't get it. It was very frustrating.
I heard an interesting, I heard an interesting criticism of Rebirth actually from one of my mutuals on Twitter. What she said was she felt like the affection mechanic system was so big that it actually kind of pulled away from the characters having real conversations with each other.
That is so, true. Absolutely.
So by making every character's affection system 100 points now, you're isolated into a lot of characters, not building relationships with each other, but largely just building relationships with Cloud.
Yeah.
Yes. Because it's everything
on
is
that true. Affection.
Right.
And it all just sort of builds up to the, yes. And it all
the
sort of builds up to
the It's like, why? Like, why is this the thing? Because I felt like I had to ignore certain things or not pursue certain avenues with certain characters. Because like, okay, I want the Tifa date. Like, that's 100% what I want. I want them to kiss, smash your faces together. Come on. But that was at a, like, that sucks because the way the game was set up is that you could miss or you'd have to push other content to the side Otherwise, you risk a random chance with whoever you're going to end up with. Because if you've got like 100 with everybody, I think up to that point or as close as possible, it's purely random. Like, it's just kind of like whatever.
Yeah.
So yeah. I didn't want to take the chance. I want to get what I want. So why should I have to ignore story? Why should I have to ignore interactions with certain characters? That's not good game design. I feel like it's just not. Yeah. The whole
completionist. I didn't even worry. I kind of knew I was going to be playing the game a second time, so I don't worry about it at that point. I went completionist my first round, and I think if I remember, I got Barrett. I got Barrett, which was fun. It was a fun scene. I knew I was going to see every single date scene, so I wasn't really wrapped up it too much in who I would get the first time. But yeah, I think I got Barrett the first time, and then the second time I played the game, I didn't worry about doing every little side quest, every little thing. And it was interesting because you already have those points from your first playthrough.
Yeah.
And it was interesting how different the game felt when you didn't have to go through
exactly
all that side content.
Yeah. Exactly.
Very different feel.
I just have to say,
some of the responses were weird and hilarious too. And I get this with every affection mechanics game. There's always that one response where it's like, wait, that's a response. Like when you're at Cosmo Canyon, and I remember the first thing I did with Aerith was like, actually I think it was my second playthrough. You can smile at her. And yeah, I was like, oh yeah, I'm gonna, and I was thinking I was gonna be encouraging to her, like actually genuinely smile at her. And then Cloud gives her the weirdest I'm like, Cloud, what is that?
Oh my god.
What is that?
That was one of the most cringe moments.
The 0 point that smiling the 0 point answer when I did it.
That was love it.
Oh, I bombed the Tifa answer too. I reloaded it. Reloaded a Tifa answer that I bombed. I bombed one of the Tifa answers, and I was like, if I have to fight that boss again, if I have to fight Hojo again, I'll do it. I can't, this cannot stand. I was like, I'm going to reload that. I can't. And I got it right. So that was, yeah. We'll throw in what we're playing now on our way out the door.
I'm at the end of Metaphor because of my job. I haven't been able, I'm like literally at the last, I think it's the second to last dungeon. I've been grinding so I can beat it. I kind of am a really big completionist, which is really bad because it takes me a year to beat a game, but I'm playing Metaphor. I also play a lot of gacha games. I play Genshin Impact and stuff like that, but the one I'm into right now, the deepest, is Metaphor, and I hope to beat it soon. I really love it. I'm a huge fan of Atlas. Persona 3 is one of my favorites. I have Reload. I'm going to start it. I really love Metaphor a lot right now, and I'm not going to spoil it for anyone because they deserve to have it blind.
I want to do a podcast on Metaphor so badly. Just putting that out there.
Very good.
It was my
thing to Persona 6.
it was easily my favorite game of last year. And I played Persona 3 Reload, which like changed my life. I was like, I haven't felt this way about a game since The Witcher 3 or Final Fantasy 7, playing Reload. And then I played Metaphor and I felt the same way about it. I'm like, I got two of these games in the same year. What an incredible thing.
Atlas Cooked.
What a
treat. What are you playing now?
Mm-hmm. I am playing Tactics Ogre Reborn. I played Unicorn Overlord before this, so I was kind of like in the mood for tactics kind of based games. Unicorn Overlord, highly recommend it. It's really cool. The story's a little bit basic, but I thought it was really progressive too. In a way that not a lot of games are. You could like partner up with a man if you wanted to as the male lead, which was unheard of, I feel like. And it was cool. It was really fun. Really fun gameplay.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'm hoping
for all the yaoi shippers.
Yeah, Persona 6 maybe. Everyone keeps saying they're going to remaster and re-release Persona 4, and they are like, please let Yosuke be a dateable option, which would be really cool. But I don't really like Yosuke in that kind of way, so we'll see. But yeah, I'm into tactics space games right now, and then I'm gonna dive back into SMT5 Vengeance after this. So
Yosuke is a deceptively well-written character, by the way. If you get past his kind of jackass facade that he puts up, he's actually
nice.
I took a deep dive into Yosuke and really analyzed his social link once, and he's a pretty decent guy. I sort of dug into that, so I had new respect for him after that. And then facts.
Right, I'm bouncing around games trying to get hooked on something. Right now, I've been doing, the last game I played was Xenoblade Chronicles, one actually. The first time I tried to play it, I struggled with the mechanics. This time I've gotten a little further, but I'm still kind of struggling with those mechanics in a way that I didn't with Xenoblade Chronicles 3. So I'm not sure if I'm going to beat it or not. Mostly just trying to bounce into getting a new obsession.
I bounced off Xenoblade, so I can Xenoblade Chronicles 2. I bounced off of it, so I'm pulling for you.
Yeah.
I'll throw mine out. I'm playing Rebirth. I'm also playing Trails from Zero, which is a fantastic game. Loving it. I'm doing a library book fetch quest. The person who took out the library book lent it to someone else, and they lent it to somebody else. And the team just really sort of kept it real on what they thought of that whole situation. And that's just a very Trails moment, and that it gives you more than you expected cheerfully. The person who introduced me to Trails told me they went from the Persona to Trails pipeline, because that was kind of what they were looking for in an RPG. And I can see it. It doesn't have the social links and the choices of dialogue, but if you like characters and arcs and sort of getting to know people better over the course of a game, it's tremendous. I can't believe we have gone. We're almost at 2 hours here, so I'm going to have to call it. You guys have been a fantastic panel.
Listen,
I have learned an immense amount about Final Fantasy VII. Thank you so much. My kids did not come down. So that is all the time we have today for the Amazing Gamers Podcast. I want to thank my fantastic guests one more time. You guys were amazing.
Thank you so much.
Absolute blast. Thanks for having me.
We could have talked for 3 more hours, too.